Hello and welcome to Chalk Talk. Today we have Michael Wood talking about King Alfred the Great.
Thank you very much. It's great to be here, suitably attired. You know, we've only just done 4 days in Glastonbury. We'd only just washed our wellies and certainly didn't expect the Chalk Valley would be like this. These Battle of the Somme conditions, aren't they? Actually, I suppose all of us have been thinking about that the last 2 or 3 days, haven't we? I was recalling my great uncle Eddie, who was in the Manchester Pals in the Somme. And I can remember when I was a kid, about six, being at my grandfather's house one day, and he said to me, maybe I was eight or nine, he said, "So what are you interested in then, lad, at school?" And I said, "History, Uncle Eddie, history." And he said, he undid his belt and dropped his trousers. And this was Sunday afternoon in my grandfather's house with all the aunties in their posh clothes and their hat pins and their bone china tea and all that. And he dropped his pants to reveal these painfully thin, white, knobbly legs with horrendous pink shrapnel wounds that had not healed. And he just went, "That's history, my lad, that's history." And I've certainly been reminded of that and all those, that amazing generation, last couple of days. Amazing. Our theme today is war. It was a theme proposed by the Jameses and Rachel as something for this year's festival. So this is part one. You'll hear more about it tomorrow. War, a life and death struggle out of which the Kingdom of England emerged. And if the war hadn't been won, would the Kingdom of England ever have emerged? We don't know. Would the English language, English literature, English ideas about governance have gone over the world? We don't know. But this is an absolutely decisive moment in our story. And it is one of the most fantastic stories in our history. The key character is Alfred the Great. And I don't need to remind a Chalk Valley audience, I know. You will remember, was it 2 or 3 years ago, we had a great evening in the big tent voting for the greatest Briton. And there were a lot of great people put forward, and a lot of great speakers. Ian Hislop, all sorts of great people, but Alfred the Great won. Quite right, of course, quite right, in Chalk Valley. We're in the heartland of Wessex here. One day we'll do a talk here about Anglo-Saxon Chalk Valley. But we're in the heartland of Wessex here. But of course, you're not the only people who thought that. He's the only great in our history, and Churchill himself, whose views on history are always interesting, shall we say. He believed Alfred was the greatest Briton and the greatest ruler in our history, which I think is so. And it's a story about the heartland of Wessex, and the story I'm going to tell you today, which is about war, is a Wiltshire story. We're going to see Wiltshire places in this talk, because the key moment in the war of 878, the decisive moment, was the victory at Edington near Westbury. I'm sure many of you know it. We're going to look at it closely. And as James has asked me to talk about the war today, I'm going to try and look at, offer you some new ideas on what actually happened then, where it happened, which I think all the experts have got wrong. And I think previous reconstructions have missed some crucial things as to why it happened in the way that it did. And at the end, I'm going to give you a few hints, too, about how Alfred not only won the war, but won the peace, laid the foundations of the story of England. As for its importance, the importance of these events, by the year 1000, the monk and teacher and homilist Elfrich said this about modern history. He said, "There have been kings who have been victorious in our history with God's help. Edgar, the greatest king of modern times, the most powerful of all the kings of the English, to whom foreign nations submitted without even war. And before him, Athelstan, who won the great victory at Brunanburh. We'll hear about that tomorrow. And afterwards lived with his people in peace. But before then, Alfred the Great, who fought so many battles against the Vikings and won his victory and protected his people."
That's the key to our story. Those of you who've been to my previous Anglo-Saxon lectures will know my fondness for, well, you recognize these pictures, do you? Yeah? Ladybird books. I mean, look, let's get serious. You'll know my talks are always a mixture of very heavy-duty paleography and manuscripts, and on the other hand, ladybird books. Got to be able to imagine, sympathetic imagination. Sometimes I think these images allow us also to critique myths, don't you think? To look at the way we see things, the way our ancestors created these stories. The tales of horror of the Viking invasions, that's the background to this. The Viking invasions of raids and invasions from the 790s onwards, which gradually destabilized the whole of England as was, and the British Isles, destroyed the kingdoms of Northumbria and the East Angles, dismembered the kingdom of Mercia, leaving only Wessex that winter. Couldn't resist these. You know, we have our funny ideas about the Vikings, don't we? I mean, when I became a student, I was really sad to learn that they didn't have horned helmets like that. It's, you know, I grew up on these images from the Ladybird books and the Eagle comics and all that sort of stuff. And images like this from children's books, this is one my dad had. I always loved this, the kind of sketchy, broody, the flames of a monastery in the fens going up. This is sometime around 869. All these great centres of English culture were being devastated by Viking raids. They couldn't be protected anymore. The kings were being knocked off, and the burly Viking heads towards his ship with a processional cross from Ely over one shoulder, rather jauntily heading for another plundering and looting expedition. And these myths lie deep in our culture, don't they? You go into the Houses of Commons, and the public galleries have got wonderful sets of pictures of these events that somehow they're the founding of our nation. Alfred the Great, this is Watts's famous painting of Alfred inciting the English to resist the Danes. The founder of the navy, all these stories that are kind of myths but have some element of truth in them. And the core narrative, of course, when Wessex stood alone, and the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle even echoes the idea of the few at that decisive moment when Alfred was defeated in the winter of 878, hardly anybody was left with him, just a small force, little whereof, and they moved from the marshy fastnesses, escaping into the Somerset Fens to this tremendous Viking attack that had come down on them, and out of it the peace that was made. You know, these are great myths in our story, and that's what we're going to look at now. And I want to take you back now to the winter of 877, 878. The East Anglian kingdom has been overrun. King of the East Angles has been killed, shot through with arrows, if the legend has it. Northumbrians have gone, their kings killed in York. Mercia has been dismembered, and a foolish king's thane has been set up, as the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle says, as a puppet king in Mercia. And now the Viking armies turn their attention to Wessex. And out of shot on this side in the Severn estuary, another blue line is heading down to the north coast of Devon. Probably a deliberate tactic to catch Alfred. They've attacked him at Twelfth Night at Chippenham. And Alfred, unsuspecting, presumably, is forced to retreat into the marshes of Somerset. And here's my first clip from the film we've made about Alfred to take that moment, if we can, Dave, take you back to the winter of 877, 878.
Her hinne bestall se herre on mitten i winter over Twelfthdal nicht, to Chippenhame. And you read on Wessex in the land, on your saddle, and meet you with us fortress over a sa a drafton. And says over us, from the mast and dal here you read on, und hing Tor in Cirto. Brutum von Könige Alfrede. Und he liebt ne Würde, um ihre Liebsche after Wut und Vor und um Mur fast nun. Caught off guard, Alfred fled into the marshes of Somerset. There, in the freezing new year of 878, he survived by hit-and-run raids, always moving from place to place in a landscape he'd known from his youth. Here at least he would be safe. The story about him comes from this time, how he stayed with a peasant woman and burnt the bread in her oven, her cakes. It's a fable, perhaps, but easy to imagine in a guerrilla war, when resistance depended for food on the local people.
People used to eat all the birds, ducks, the swans.
So those stories that they didn't have much to eat are probably true.
If you caught a duck, you'd be well fed. Yes, yeah, it's catching it as well, really. Because he can fly a lot faster than you could walk for this. It'd be a harsh life to live out here, I think.
Right,
yeah,
right.
If you didn't have a home to go to.
Right. And the water supply, what would the water be like here?
It's not pleasant. Most of the time, it's, you'd probably boil it to drink it.
Yeah.
Yeah, so you don't want to be falling in it either, because it's wet and sticky and muddy and deep.
But there's one story about that time that emerged within living memory. One day, Alfred, here in the woods, met a wandering hermit, a poor pilgrim, and Alfred shared with him the tiny amount of food that he'd got left. And the pilgrim blessed him and then went on his way. That afternoon, Alfred and his men made an almost miraculous catch of fish in one of the lakes here, so for the first time in days they ate well. That night, the pilgrim appeared to Alfred in his dreams. It's Saint Cuthbert himself. Told Alfred, don't lose courage. You will triumph in the end, and your descendants will be rulers of all England. In such divinely sent dreams, medieval people saw the future. From that moment, Alfred began to create his own myth of destiny.
Go, Alfred! They're fabulous stories, aren't they? I think that moment of the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle, you could probably hear it without seeing the subtitles there. On midne winter of a twelfth nicht to Chippenham. Yeah? And how many of the people submitted to the Vikings. Only a small force was left with Alfred. Little were they. And most of them gave in at that point. Brutons, se Könige. Alfred, the myth is being created, the myth is being created. But behind the myth, a real story. And long ago I suggested we should call that story the England that Alfred dreamed, which would be achieved by his descendants over three or four generations. That's wonderful story of St. Cuthbert, which is recorded in Chesterless Street in Northumbria in the 940s. Is within living memory of these stories. They're already constructing their idea of how these things came to be. So, but we're back there in the marshes with Alfred at this point. There he is down there. Guthrum and the Viking armies are going all the way across Wessex. The Anglo-Saxon Chronicle talks about the people who were driven off Fersa across the sea. Alfred's biographer, Bishop Asser, corroborates that by saying that many people fled from Hampshire into Gaul, actually abandoned the country. And one person who did that, I've put these as dots here, can you see? Those are the estates of Wulfheda, who is the alderman of Wiltshire. Sorry to say this, but and he deserted his lord, according to a later document, and his estates were confiscated. Those are his chief estates, the red dots, the family church at Kintbury, where all the family were buried. He was married to a woman from the royal family. But that story just gives you a sense of the terrible pressure on this moment, that things are, the kingship is really wobbling. Alfred, indeed, is only one branch of an extended kin. The Vikings might do what they've done in Mercia, which is put up somebody else. But there they are, sweeping down to Winchester while he's in the marshes. And I love this image from the Ladybird book. It's corny, isn't it? But the things of childhood stick with you, don't they? You know, the man of destiny, the straw punt. Can you see the punt and the punt pole? Asser describes these grana paludosissima, the thick, deep marshes through which you could only progress by punt. And the Ladybird artist has rather beautifully rendered that, don't you think? And the story of the cakes. Now, you know, the scholars all say it's not true. But as I said in the commentary, it's the kind of thing that happens in a guerrilla war. And the story is a 10th century story. It's almost within living memory of these events, several later versions of it. And I wonder whether there is some truth to the tale. You know, you can imagine some old thane in the 940s dandling his grandson on his knee. I was a teenager back then. You'll never guess what happened. The old lady, Alfred, so tied up with his loss that he lets the bread, panem, burn in her oven, and the lady scolding him, the peasant woman, you lazy good-for-nothing, you'd be the first one to eat it, what are you doing? The chronicle records the conversation. Little did the poor woman imagine that the, you know. And it's taken its place in all those great moral tales, a bit like Robert the Bruce and Spider, isn't it? I love that one, the kind of incredibly depressed cigarette card from above. I don't know what to do. Pick yourself up, Alfred. And this great one from Punch during the Battle of Britain. You won't read it at the back. Well, I perhaps they are a shade overcooked, but what does that matter in wartime? Great, aren't they? These enduring tales. But now the fight back begins. We're into the spring of 878, and Alfred has still got loyal supporters. The alderman of Devon up here has engaged the Viking army and killed, in a surprise attack, killed 800 or 900 of them in a battle up on the Devon coast. Athelnoth, the loyal alderman of Somerset, is based in one of the big forests here. We don't know which one. I'd guess it was Selwood. And Alfred now begins to mount the counterattack. So now, he chooses the moment to mount the attack. And this is what's going to happen. The main Danish base is Chippenham. That's where they brought back captured herds, cattle, you know, food on the hoof. They've made a big base at Chippenham. But Alfred's move from Athelney, which is down here, across into Wiltshire, Is it determined by the Viking movement down to Eddington? Have they already made their base here? That's what I think has happened, because we know about the two night stops. Alfred does this journey in 3 days, two night stops, and heading to Eddington. And if we just go back, that's Eddington. So I think what's happened is the Viking army has come down and made Eddington their base underneath Salisbury Plain, and that's where Alfred makes his lightning attack to get them. Ethandun. That's the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle. We've also got an account of this by Alfred's biographer. I put this in just to show you that, you know, we've got the original manuscript of the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle written in the early 890s in Wessex. in Alfred's court, this is the official account of these things, you know, and Asa is the Welsh bishop from Dyfed, who was with Alfred at this time, though not at the time of the battle. The manuscript was burned in the Cotton Fire in the early 18th century, completely. So we're dependent on a later edition. This is Wise's edition of 1722. But Asa gives an account of these things as well. And Asa sometimes in his account says, the king himself showed me this place. The naked thorn where the Battle of Ashdown was fought, the king himself showed me. So this is horse's mouth stuff as well. And he talks about how at the worst moment, Alfred only had his household, his vassalis, and the Somerset levies with him. He had only had his small force, but indefatigably fought against the pagans until he moved in the seventh week after Easter, that's the week leading up to Pentecost. And his first stop was at a place called Edgebert's Stone. This is the night stop where the levies of Somerset and Wiltshire and Western Hampshire and all of Hampshire who hadn't fled overseas, the leaders and so on, they met him. And Asa says they were overjoyed to see him so much as if he'd risen from the dead. Fantastic moment. And the question of where Edgebert's stone was, the rendezvous for the campaign, has been debated for a long time. This is a map of the bounds of Selwood. Asa says it was just on the eastern side of Selwood. Two ancient roads lead from the Somerset marshes, the Via Regia, which here is the 303. It's a very, very ancient road. Or the old Hardway or Holloway, I think the old Army Way, which actually ran through Selwood Forest, goes right underneath Alfred's Tower. I'm sure many of you know the place. Alfred's Tower was built in order to commemorate the rendezvous before the attack that saved England, if you, as they put it on the monument. And there's Penselwood, and the Shire meeting place is there. I don't know whether you can see this at the back. This is 1842 map of this corner of Selwood. Wiltshire, Dorset, Somerset, Penselwood's in Somerset, and the Shire stone at that point in the 19th century was still visible at a pond on a linen flax factory there on the corner. So I think that's where the rendezvous was. And the following day, they pressed on to a place called Eyley Oak, says the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle. And again, we're very, very lucky to be able to actually pin this down on the ground. Some of you will recognize this landscape here, the Deverells coming down here, Warminster at the top, the plain there, and the forests here. And in Southley Wood was the site of Eyley Oak, which was the Hundred Oak, the English hundreds, the local system of local government up to the 19th century, often met in the open air and often met at landmarks like an ancient oak, and that was Eyley Oak. And we know that it was in this place called Robin Hood's Bower, which is now under a plantation, but you can still see the earthworks in Southley Wood. So we know that that was where the West Saxon army, now gathered together with the troops from Hampshire, Somerset, and Wiltshire, and Alfred's own following and his thanes and his leaders who'd stuck with him, where they gathered, prepared themselves, probably prayed to holy relics. They may even have stayed up all night praying with bishops doing the liturgies and so on. And then just before dawn, launched their attack on the Viking army at Ethandun, about 10 kilometers away. And they rode, according to the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle, and mounted armies, these Anglo-Saxon royal armies. They fight on foot, but they're mounted armies. And so they circle round the plain and attack the Vikings at Edington. So why Edington? And where did this battle take place? Well, first of all, this is Alfred's will, and you can see it's a royal tun. Alfred owns Edington. It's a major royal establishment. And this document, which has never been reproduced, the British Library shot it for me for this lecture, takes us back to the 9th century, and Alfred's father meeting at Edington. You can see on the second line, Ethandun, with his bishops and his thanes and his earls and so on. It's a major royal residence. And that means it had a royal hall, It had barns, outbuildings, stables, a chapel, latrines, the whole works, with and defended in some way. It's a major centre, and we know from Domesday Book that the population would have been around 300 in the 11th century, that it was a rich place, it had flocks. The cartellaries in the 1300s speak of flocks, 4,000 sheep and so on. So the Vikings have chosen this forward base because it's defended, it's got accommodation, it's got a royal hall, and it's got food. And it's from here they're probably intending to push now to catch Alfred. But he moves first, and he moves along. This is another reason why it's Eddington, what's called the King's Way, the Via Regia. And all these places are overnight stopping places for the Anglo-Saxon kings on their itineraries, indeed right up into the 1200s. It's astounding that this old system of itinerant monarchies still continues. In the 1270s, Edward I goes from Marlborough to Avebury to All Canning's and stays overnight at Eddington on his way south. So these are old routes, and the Vikings have chosen it because it's a royal residence. So where was the royal residence at Eddington? Because that's going to tell us where the battle was fought. All the scholarship has been mesmerized by the plain, the great Iron Age camps like Battlesbury. They're just antiquarian concoctions, these names. The battle wasn't fought on the waste down. The battle was fought at Ethandun, the royal tun. And where was the royal tun? Here's the King's Way, the modern road here. And there is a very, very interesting feature right in the middle of Eddington. When you look at it on the old maps, can you see the rectangle? Yeah, let's isolate it. The vicarage there today. There's pretty much no doubt in my mind, although I'd like to get into the old vicarage owner's beautiful lawn and dig some test pits, if they wouldn't mind. But it's a very, very pronounced raised plateau with sunken lanes around it. Look at the steepness of it on the side of the village hall. Can you see? It's a really, really steep plateau by the road. And you see the steps coming out of the sunken lane going up onto the top, and the sunken lane round the side. So that's the location of the royal tun, it seems to me. We'll need to establish it further by finds and stuff like that. Metal detectorists so far haven't got very much from Eddington, but I'd be pretty certain that that's what it was. The Vikings are camped here and around here. Alfred attacks at dawn, according to Asa. He's ridden his 10 kilometers coming this way, up the King's Way. He probably comes out into the field here, and they attack. And the Vikings are able to make a shield wall because a fierce pitched battle takes place. The chronicle narrative is so thrilling, isn't it? Laconic as it is, you know, it's produced in Alfred's circle. You can see the chronicler's spirits just rising there as he describes that moment. And thus imb anna to Ethandune, and there ye fought with Alnethun a hera, with all the Viking army, and hina ye filimede, and him after rad offer that ye weorc, and he pursued them back to their fortification. Again, there's been a lot of speculation. Oh, are they talking about the fortifications on the downs? You know, Battlesbury Hill. That's all nonsense. They pursue back to Chippenham, and our other authorities actually name Chippenham. So it's Chippenham where the Vikings are besieged. The survivors are besieged, and after 2 weeks, miserable and starving, they surrender, and a whole new dimension is given to the story of England. This has got so many wonderful anachronisms, hasn't it? Forgetting the helmet and all that, but the idea that Alfred and Guthrum handed feather pens to each other like they're some kind of European Union conference is absolutely fantastic, isn't it, don't you think? Their ceremonies were much more, well, blood brother swearing, ring giving, and oath taking. But it stuck. Guthrum gave his hostages, agreed to retreat from Wessex, and stuck to his part of the bargain. Alfred, it wasn't the end of Alfred's wars, of course. He fights wars right through to the end. I get the impression of him, you know, he's born in 849 and he died in 899. He's only 50. I get the impression of somebody worn out by fighting. 16 major battles he fought. Huge campaigns, you know, battle-hardened warrior by the time he was 22. So it wasn't the end of it. And there were many difficult and dangerous campaigns. But the victory at Edington was decisive for the future. Truly decisive for the future. It's one of the great moments in English history. And just very swiftly, the aftermath, there's a whole series of events that take place. Alfred's bought himself time, and in the next decade or two, creates a network of fortresses all over the south, from Exeter to Kent, and from the Thames down to Porchester, controlling the rivers, river estuaries, the main routes, refurbishing Roman forts, refurbishing Iron Age forts, building new ones, in an effort to make sure that in future no Viking raid can do to Wessex what the Guthrum and others had done in the times before Guthrum. And of course the Ladybird book, with its very rather delightful nationalistic message to kids in about 1960, has them, you know, banging in the shire posts to mark out the shires of England. An old tradition about Alfred creating shires. But there's some truth behind all this, and especially we can trace the, you know, his economic measures, the urban regeneration, if I dare put it like that, restoring the old Roman circuit of London, producing a fine coinage based on late antique models, at a time when the coinage had been debased. He's imposing order. He sees himself as a lawgiver. Again, it's a lovely fantasy, isn't it? The paper, the quill pens, the crown. No English king wore a crown before Athelstan, and it was a lot less fancy than that. But these myths do encapsulate what he did as a result of these victories. The consolidation of the south, the consolidation of Wessex, which would be the core of the future Kingdom of England. And all of it, we know from his own writings, driven by a conception that the key job of the king was not just to fight battles and protect his people, but to show and use in his governance wisdom. Wisdom held Æthelsin. He ruled with wisdom. And some of the material productions from his time, wonderful brooches and stuff like this, the figure of wisdom on them, figure of wisdom on the famous Alfred jewel that was found near Athelney. And this goes further to Alfred's so-called translation program. In a very moving preface to his English version of Gregory the Great's book on pastoral care, it's a bishop's pastoral care, but he turns it into a king's pastoral care. He talks about the study of letters and the knowledge of Latin being eroded and gone in southern England, effectively, and that now nobody could construe a letter in Latin. And he set out to do something about it by translating some of the books which it is most needful for people to know. He even invented a candle that marked out the hours. You see, the Ladybird book has carefully watched the Asser text. And just very briefly, before I show you the last clip, some of these manuscripts survive. And I find them among the most moving memorials in our culture, really, the most moving survivals in our culture. This is a copy of the pastoral care which was sent to Worcester. You can see at the top, you can probably read it if you're in the front. This book shall to Worcester. This book shall go to Worcester. He had copies made and they were sent out to the bishoprics. And at the front, at the top there,
Alfred Kooning, hathath great, hatath greatan, werfeth bishop, his wardom loveliter and friendliter. You can almost hear it, can't you? Sends his greetings, his words loving and friendly, loveliter and friendliter. It's the covering letter to the translation. And this is the cultural project that they're engaging in. It's absolutely fantastic stuff, isn't it? He corresponds with the Patriarch of Jerusalem. He's trying to connect with the ancient Christian links of the English, even in the Near East. You can see at the top there, this is a book of an Anglo-Saxon doctor with from Alfred's time, with a collection of recipes, and at the top, and cures. This came from Elias, the Patriarch on Jerusalem. It's a wide-ranging and extraordinary mind. He translates Boethius' Consolation of Philosophy as a book which is about confronting fate and confronting disaster in the world as they read it. And the copy survives in the Vatican, as you'll see in a moment, that they worked on with the annotations in the margin. Before I show you the clip, I was reminded recently reading a book by a great late antique scholar, Arnaldo Momigliano, who, like Primo Levi, was a North Italian Jew, went through Second World War and came out as a student of late antique and early medieval civilization, believing in the humanistic message of these people who, in the ruins of Rome, tried to rebuild Christian culture on the basis of the classical legacy, as well as their own Germanic roots. And he says, we of the age of iron, coming out of the Second World War, have learned not to disdain the lesser people, those who saw it as their duty to pass on the texts and who believed in education for the next generations, you know. And it's a very, very moving thing, this. And it takes Alfred beyond the realm of not only any English ruler, I think, or British ruler, but as one of the great rulers of all time and place. Let's see this final clip then, Dave, if we may, which touches on this question of how they won the peace. How Alfred tried to rebuild culture. To finish off, I'll throw it open to questions if you like, we did follow their track because there is a continuity in English culture from the Anglo-Saxons to today. It used to be unfashionable to say this, but clearly, you know, you look at the continuity of English prose from Alfred's works all the way through to Chaucer and on. The continuity of English poetry, the deep-rooted themes and ideas and even vocabulary of English poetry, the ideas of English rulership that we bequeath to the world, the very origin of our parliamentary system starts in Alfred's grandson's time with these assemblies, legislative assemblies, continuity of English law. The roots of all this lie back in that period, and I hope you can see just from this brief glimpse how fantastic this period is. And they certainly, if we can go back to the PowerPoint for the last couple of shots, Dave, that'd be great. Yeah, they certainly did. You know, of course, they made their myths about Alfred, not just in Victorian times, but in the 10th century, as the founder of their royal line, the lawgiver, the peacemaker, the pious Christian king, all that kind of stuff on Victorian church windows. The real image, of course, is grittier, harder, but no less, well, more compelling, I think. Couple of final things about Eddington, given that our theme today was the war for Wessex that underlies the war and the making of England. This is Alfred's will. Survives in a wonderful 11th century manuscript in the British Library. And there he is, Sich Alfred Wessaxner König mit Goldes Gefe.
and with the witness of my Witan, my counselors, he has to browbeat them into accepting his line of descent. Remember, he was the fourth of the brothers who'd ruled. The others had children. His children didn't automatically succeed, so he fought the succession before he died very vigorously. And his will is a really interesting document with a huge amount of bequests to people. But he's a sentimental guy in some ways, and he leaves one place to his daughter, Athelflaed, the Lady of the Mercians, one place, which is Wellow in Hampshire, which I think could have been her birthplace. He leaves three places to his wife, Ealhswith, and those three places, Lambourne, where the Battle of Ashdown was fought, Wantage, which is where Alfred was born, and Eddington. Those are the only three bequests to his wife. And the royal family never forgot the importance of Eddington. Here's a wonderful charter from 957 with the young King Eadwy on the throne. And here he is meeting with all his council at Eddington, Ethandun. And the top of the charter says, here, by the grace of God, and by the, how shall I translate it, by the inspiring model of the prosapia, the stem of my ancestors. And the date of the charter, May the 9th. If that's not the date of the battle, I'd be surprised if it wasn't within 24 hours. So they're meeting at Eddington on the anniversary of the battle and commemorating the descendants, and commemorating the ancestors. They never forgot that connection. And in the terrible crisis, which you'll hear about tomorrow, when the Battle of Brunanburh, where north of England fell, the Midlands invaded, the whole edifice of the kingdom, the new Kingdom of England, threatened to break down, Athelstan goes to Athelney and asks the monks to pray for his soul and the soul of my grandfather. Not his father, not anybody else in the family, my grandfather. And that's the descent down to him. I've spoken of this as a 3 or 4 generation project, the key three, Alfred, Athelflaed, Athelflaed. Cet Alfred est la plus sage de toute femme séculaire, says this medieval writer. That she was a remarkable person. You'll hear more about her tomorrow in this Making of England. There she is. And Athelstan, with whom the line ended, of course, the descent down to our queen goes around him. He had no children, but nonetheless, gifted by Alfred the Great with a sword, a cloak, and a Saxon belt as a 5 or 6 year old at Omen Regni in prophecy of a kingdom. At the end of the 10th century, one of the great writers of the time and great politicians of the time and great churchmen of the time spoke about the kings of this period as mature in wisdom, far-sighted, and hard to overcome in any conflict. And that, it seems to me, is the story of Alfred. And we'll hear more tomorrow on the next part of the tale. And we have a little time for questions. Thank you. Yeah.
What size
armies? Good question. What size armies? There was a time, 20 or 30 years ago, when people thought of them in terms of hundreds. But I think now the feeling is that, you know, especially the Irish annals are pretty accurate in the size of their fleets, and big Viking fleets in Ireland. they range in size, but the big ones are a couple of hundred ships. So you are talking about thousands of men, I would think. The army that attacked Devon loses about 900 dead. And that's probably most of the army. Some perhaps were able to escape. That's a side army. I would have thought Guthrum's army would be 3,000 or 4,000. I think the great expeditionary armies, for instance, the army Athelstan invaded Scotland with, there's no reason why it couldn't have been much smaller than the army of Edward II at the time of Bannockburn, you know, 14,000, 15,000. The Welsh expected Athelstan's army when they fought the decisive battle with him, or at least when they hoped that battle would take place, to be 18,000. So they're big armies, possibly. I think there's a revision of this, but I would guess 3,000 or 4,000 at Edington. And yes, gentlemen there.
I believe, and certainly everyone who lives in Swanage believes, that Alfred fought a decisive and important naval battle in Swanage Bay. Is this true? When did it take place? And was it as important as the people in Swanage believe?
Well, it was very important, but it wasn't a battle. It was actually a great storm. I think, if I'm remembering right, 120 Viking ships wrecked off Swanage in a great storm. And it's the year before Edington. So a very important moment in the campaign could have perhaps made all the difference to, you know, you look at Viking strategy and their kings were able to cooperate. You know, you've got an army coming down from Gloucester to Chippenham and then attacking Wessex. You've got an army coming across from Difford, wintering in Difford, and then coming across to Devon. And you've got another fleet had been destroyed in the previous autumn, you know, by the forces of nature. So not a battle, but the people of Swanage can still celebrate it. Gentlemen there.
Thank you. I'm a resident of Edington. And you've blown out of the water the local legend, and based on previous reenactments, that the final battle was at Luckenbottom. Bottom.
Yeah.
Which is a coombe, rather like here.
Yeah.
We actually live on the left-hand side of the Sunken Lane, Parsonage Lane, that you showed on your slide. And I know the landowner of the old vicarage, and I'm sure that we would be very pleased. Well, he's got a very nice lawn, I know.
And I noticed, yes, I noticed that.
I'm sure you'd have the funds to replace it once you've done your inquiries.
Yeah.
But genuinely, I'm also on the parish council, and we'd be very interested to generate some interest following your books, because clearly there's a lot of history there that needs to be told in a different way, despite the fact we do have Ethandune on the road signs coming into Edington.
Yeah, it's a fantastic site. It's a fantastic site. And made for an Anglo-Saxon villa regalis, as they would have called it. It's exactly the same size as the Cheddar Palace site that was excavated by Philip Ratz, you know. So there's room there for a big hall, you know, 110 feet long, perhaps. And all the ancillary buildings which went with it. The reason I showed you those charters with the royal assemblies there is just to prove that, you know, a very large peacetime assembly with bishops and earls and thanes and the court could stay there. There's a well, I hear, as well in the old vicarage, you know. Yes. So, and it's very well supplied by wells along the main road below the
There's Escott. A famous monk's well just along the 3098.
Yeah. So, you know, you've only got to look at that shot with the train going in front of the downs to see that all these reconstructions by quite eminent scholars, some of them, that they fought on top of the downs are completely impossible, you know. And certainly they couldn't have come down from the downs onto the site. It's far too steep, you know. The logical conduct of the campaign is what I've outlined to you, and I'm sure that's what happened, you know. When it says the battle was fought at Ethandune, it's exactly the same as those charters. The council met at Ethandune. The king received his ambassadors at Ethandune. So that's the site I would look at very, very closely. And there's no doubt there's more going to come out of that, because it stays a royal site. As I say, Edward I stayed there in 1272, that late on, that network of royal villas. So tell the owner, I'll be along with my spade and my resistivity team very soon.
Well, genuinely, we'd be very pleased to see you.
Great. One more. Time for one more. Somebody in the back.
Sorry about that. Long way away. I was just wondering why, rather naively, why Gethenden just didn't finish him off. Because in the time where he was staying in Chippenden, he'd had time to build a fort and burn cakes and do all sorts of other things. And in that time, presumably, why didn't he just finish off what he'd started, having dominated the rest of Britain? Is there any sense of why?
Sorry, you mean why didn't Guthrum, having captured Chippenham and made his base,
exactly,
why didn't Guthrum finish Alfred off?
Yeah, exactly.
Well, the answer is that there was a campaign for several weeks, that whole swathes of Wessex were submitted to the invaders, to the Danes. Some of them were driven overseas, as I explained. Alfred took refuge in a landscape that the Danes simply couldn't get at. You know, that's the point about the marshes of Somerset. Even today, you saw those pictures in the flooded year that we shot from Ling Tower. So they couldn't get at him. And you're in a landscape which any regular army couldn't deal with. And it's a guerrilla war. And Alfred knows the landscapes and the waterways. You know, he's been an Atheling. Atheling Eye is that's the name. It's one of the territories owned by the Anglo-Saxon princes. So as a young prince, he would have hunted there, you know. So you know the waterways, and you've got the Somerset boatman who can take you where you've got to go. So you're constantly on the move. What's interesting is the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle says it wasn't until Easter, which is 23rd of March, that they built the fort at Athelney. And even that was surrounded by water with one causeway, massive defensive thing at Ling, but it takes him that long, you see, from Twelfth Night to the 23rd of March. He's on the run. So I'm sure they would have loved to get him and do what they did to King Edmund of East Anglia, but they couldn't.
Thank you.
Michael, I think we're going to need to draw it to a close there. It's not often that our talks generate a permission to dig, so I'm absolutely delighted. You've had lots of witnesses there, so thank you to that gentleman. Michael will be signing books in the Waterstones tent afterwards. Please join me in a very large round of applause for a fascinating talk. Thank you.
Well, that's it for today. But there's plenty more for you to enjoy at cvhf.org.uk or wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you for listening.